friends and loved ones, this is a program that suggests existing in reality, the reality that is real rather than a reality which is not real, which we might prefer. And the reality is that President Joe Biden has clinched the 2024 Democratic presidential nomination. It's over on the basis of a number of primaries that were held last night. And it is now time to deal with reality. Do we want the next president of the United States to be Joe Biden, or do we want the next president of the United States to be Donald Trump? Here is the moment last night when CNN was able to make this projection on the basis of the results. Take a listen.
Second.
That's not enough.
Hold on 1 second. I'm going to come right back to you, but I do just want everyone to know we do now have a CNN projection.
Wow.
And we can now project at CNN that President Biden has enough delegates to win the Democratic nomination for the 2024 presidential election. And as we've been saying, this is a major and historic moment in the race. Biden now pushing ahead with his reelection bid, and the state that got him over the edge, a state that got him over the top. We'll see in hindsight how significant that is the state of Georgia, where polls just closed at the top of the hour. Took us just under 11 minutes here to make this formal call. And we are now projecting Georgia is a win for Biden.
All right. So my approach going forward, before I even get to that, OK, let's have the conversation. Right. Protest votes, symbolic votes, sending a message, showing I'm really upset, preferring somebody younger. OK, it's all valid. It's all valid. It's part of the democratic process. 1000%. We now have to really couch our actions in the following way. Am I taking an action that is going to make the next president be Joe Biden, or am I taking an action that's going to make the next president be Donald Trump? It's not about shaming. It's not about saying that we would be better off with a ranked choice voting or single transferable vote system. We would. It's not about saying we wouldn't be better off with a national popular vote. We would be better off with a national popular vote. It's the reality that if you vote for Cornel West, by writing him in, I think in just about every state other than Utah, maybe because he's not on any ballots. If you write in Cornel West, it's an action that helps Trump become the next president. My ethics and morality do not comport or coincide with actions that help Donald Trump become the next president. And I feel compelled to say this only because of the emails I continue to get. This isn't because I personally will benefit from Biden being president. I know I get emails about, David, you're going to cry when Trump becomes president. I can't wait to see the tears. I've been super honest. And, you know, I was just in D.C. and met with a bunch of other creators. We all realize we do better. We make more money if Trump is the next president. So this idea that it's going to be a personal devastation as someone who lives in a blue state. You know, everybody who was there mostly was in either New York or California, essentially. It's not because we are going to be the ones that suffer under Trump. It's because many people would suffer. Now, I know there's this idea of, well, might Trump put you in a camp or shut you down? Or I'm not big enough for Trump to pay attention to me. OK, so that's not a concern. So because I can't in good faith undertake an action that helps Trump become the next president, I will be voting for Joe Biden. Everybody can use whatever sort of barometer, test, whatever you want to do. But my priority is we've got to keep Trump out. If he wins, the show will do great. You know, I'll benefit financially, but it would be the wrong thing and a bad thing for so many tens of millions of Americans. So Joe Biden is now the nominee. And we are going to have to work within that reality. And important in considering what that reality is also understanding what's happening on the Republican side, which is very similar. In the midst of endless legal chaos and hundreds of millions of dollars in judgments against him, failed former President Donald Trump a civilly liable rapist with 91 felony counts against him, has also clinched the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. We learned that yesterday as well. And this is the first presidential rematch since 1956. That's, let me think, 2024 minus 1956. That's what, like 140 years or something like that. Maybe my math is off a bit. This is something that happened very quickly in terms of securing party nominations. As you can see here, we have very early nominations secured on both sides. And indeed, Donald Trump is what MAGA and Republicans have chosen. Now, interestingly enough, many Republicans did not want this. Nikki Haley, even after dropping out last week, getting a bunch of votes in some of yesterday's prime.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I think the consequences of a ground operation in Rafah in the current circumstances would be catastrophic for the people of Gaza, for the Palestinians. It would be catastrophic for the humanitarian situation. It would be catastrophic all around.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is vowing to move ahead with plans to attack Rafah, where over 1.4 million Palestinians are seeking refuge. We'll go to Rafah to speak with Mohammed Abu Lebda, a poet and translator who used to translate Edgar Allan Poe, now translates for the International Medical Corps. Then we remember U.S. peace activist Rachel Corrie, killed 21 years ago when she was crushed to death by an Israeli military bulldozer in Rafah as she tried to prevent the demolition of the home of a Palestinian pharmacist.
The bulldozer proceeded toward Rachel, that she took a position indicating that she was not going to move. She was in her orange jacket. When it kept coming, she rose on the mound, and the eyewitnesses testified that her head rose above the top of the blade of the bulldozer so she could clearly be seen, but the bulldozer continued and proceeded over her.
We'll speak with Rachel Corrie's parents, who've devoted their lives to her cause, and to one of her colleagues with the International Solidarity Movement, who witnessed her killing and held her hand as she lay dying. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Israeli military has conducted another major raid on Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. There are reports Israeli snipers are firing at people inside the hospital, which has also been attacked by tanks and drones. According to Palestinian health officials, about 30,000 people have been sheltering at the hospital. Israel said the raid was being conducted to target Hamas militants. At least 80 Palestinians have been detained at the hospital, including Al Jazeera correspondent Ismail Al-Ghul. This comes as the UN aid agency UNRWA is reporting 1 in 3 children under the age of 2 in northern Gaza are now actually malnourished as Israel continues to block aid from entering Gaza. UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell said, quote, "The speed at which this catastrophic child malnutrition crisis in Gaza has unfolded is shocking, especially when desperately needed assistance has been at the ready just a few miles away," she said. On Friday, a ship carrying 200 tons of aid arrived in Gaza from Cyprus, but aid groups say far more aid is desperately needed. Palestinian mothers say they've nothing to feed their children.
"What has this child done to suffer from hunger? I cannot find milk for 5 shekels or a packet of milk from the agency. There, the normal milk is for 150. There's no work. There's no food, no drinks. We are eating plants. We started eating pigeon food, donkey food. We are like animals."
Despite growing international criticism, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is vowing to move ahead with plans to attack the city of Rafah, where over 1.4 million Palestinians are seeking refuge. On Sunday, he also criticized U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's call for new elections in Israel. Netanyahu spoke on CNN.
I think what he said is totally inappropriate. It's inappropriate for to go to a sister democracy and try to replace the elected leadership there. That's something that Israel, the Israeli public, does on its own, and we're not a banana republic.
Talks are continuing in Qatar over a possible temporary ceasefire in Gaza. Over the weekend, Hamas offered a new three-phase ceasefire plan that includes the initial release of the remaining five female hostages and 35 men who are old, sick, or injured in exchange for 700 to 1,000 Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Hamas said it would only release Israeli soldiers held captive after a permanent ceasefire is reached. On Sunday, the Irish Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, and his partner Matthew Barrett joined President Biden during a St. Patrick's Day celebration at the White House. The Irish Prime Minister called for a ceasefire in Gaza.
The Irish people are deeply troubled about the catastrophe that's unfolding before our eyes in Gaza. And when I travel the world, leaders often ask me why the Irish have such empathy for the Palestinian people. And the answer is simple. We see our history in their eyes, a story of displacement, of dispossession, a national identity questioned and denied, forced emigration, discrimination, and now hunger. So we support your work and that of your administration to secure a humanitarian ceasefire and to create the space for lasting peace. The people of Gaza desperately need food, medicine, and shelter. And most especially, they need the bombs to stop. This has to stop on both sides, the hostages brought home and humanitarian relief allowed in.
Meanwhile, protests continued around the world over the weekend, including in Dublin, Ireland, where protesters called out the Prime Minister for joining President Biden at the White House. In San Sebastian, Spain, demonstrators rallied before laying down on the ground next to a massive banner depicting part of Picasso's famous anti-war painting, Guernica.
It's so tough to be a witness to a genocide that we can do nothing about. We can just bring a grain of sand, even as a tribute.
Other large protests were held in Chile, Norway, Australia, Jordan, and across the United States. Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned the West against sending troops to Ukraine, saying it could lead to World War III. Putin made the remarks earlier today after he won an unprecedented fifth term in office. Russian election officials say Putin won 87% of the vote in this weekend's election, where opposition anti-war candidates were barred from running. Putin spoke at a victory rally Sunday.
No matter who wants to frighten us, no matter how they want to suppress us, our will, consciousness, as I have already said, no one has ever succeeded in anything like this in history. It has not worked now and will not work in the future. Never.
The election came just weeks after Putin's most prominent critic, Alexei Navalny, died in an Arctic prison. Navalny's wife, Yulia, urged supporters to gather outside polling stations Sunday at noon to protest Putin. Yulia Navalnaya spoke after voting at the Russian embassy in Berlin.
You're probably wondering what I wrote on the ballot papers, who I voted for. Of course I wrote Navalny's surname, because it just can't be so that a month before the election, and already during the presidential campaign, Putin's main opponent, already imprisoned, was murdered.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky condemned the Russian election, which was also held in parts of occupied Ukraine.
There is not a single bit of legitimacy in the simulation of an election, and there cannot be. This actor should be on trial in The Hague. That's what we have to ensure together with everyone in the world that values life and decency.
Zelensky's comment on Sunday came 2 days after a Russian missile attack on the Ukrainian city of Odessa killed at least 21 people and injured 73. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump campaigned in Ohio over the weekend and warned there would be a bloodbath in the United States if he lost the election to Joe Biden.
Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
During the same speech, Trump escalated his dehumanizing attacks on migrants.
If you call them people, I don't know if you call them people. In some cases, they're not people, in my opinion. But I'm not allowed to say that because the radical left says that's a terrible thing to say. They say you have to vote against him because did you hear what he said about humanity? I've seen the humanity, and these humanity, these are bad. These are animals, okay?
Trump also called for the jailing of lawmakers who took part in the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. In related news, Trump's former Vice President Mike Pence has said he, quote, cannot in good conscience endorse Trump's reelection bid. In other Trump news, Nathan Wade has resigned as special prosecutor in the Georgia election interference case against the former president. At issue is Wade's undisclosed romantic relationship with Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis. On Friday, a judge ruled Willis could remain on the case if Wade resigned. Meanwhile, in New York, the judge overseeing Trump's hush money trial has agreed to delay the start of the trial until mid-April. Dozens of U.S. citizens left Haiti on a chartered flight Sunday amidst an escalating political and humanitarian crisis. The flight left from an airport in Cap-Haïtien because Haiti's main airport in Port-au-Prince remains shut down. About 1.4 million Haitians are on the verge of famine as street violence has disrupted efforts by aid groups to distribute food. Some aid containers have also been seized by armed groups. Last week, Haiti's unelected Prime Minister Ariel Henry agreed to resign once a seven-person transitional council was formed, but the makeup of the council has not yet been announced. The military junta in Niger has ordered U.S. troops to leave Niger in a major setback to U.S. military operations in Africa. 6 years ago, the U.S. built a $110 million drone base in northern Niger. The U.S. currently has about 1,000 troops in the West African nation. The announcement comes months after France was forced to pull its troops from Niger as well. Colonel Amadou Abdramani spoke on Saturday.
On cooperation between the two countries, in particular military cooperation in the fight against terrorists. The U.S. presence on the territory of the Republic of Niger is illegal and violates all the constitutional and democratic rules which would require the sovereign people, in particular through its elected representatives, to be consulted on the installation of a foreign army on its territory.
In Senegal, opposition leaders Ousmane Sonko and Bassirou Diomaye Faye have been released from prison ahead of next Sunday's rescheduled presidential election. The release comes after outgoing President Macky Sall granted the men amnesty. Sall had sought to postpone the elections until after his term ends in April, but was forced to backtrack following massive protests and after a court ruled the move was unlawful. Bassirou Diomaye Faye is one of 19 candidates who will appear on the ballot. He's backed by the popular opposition figure Ousmane Sonko, who himself is barred from running. President Sall has named former Prime Minister Amadou Ba as his pick to succeed him. As the humanitarian crisis worsens in Sudan, UN officials are urging the Sudanese military and rival rapid support forces to immediately allow aid deliveries to save nearly 5 million people from catastrophic hunger in the coming months. Nearly 18 million people are already facing acute food insecurity after nearly a year of war. Fighting has devastated agricultural production, disrupted trades, blocked most access to humanitarian aid. UNICEF warns hundreds of thousands of Sudanese children suffering from severe malnutrition.
The numbers of acutely malnourished children are rising, and the lean season hasn't even begun. Nearly 3.7 million children are projected to be acutely malnourished this year in Sudan, including 730,000 who need life-saving treatment. The needs for children in Khartoum alone are massive, but this is also true in Darfur, where I was last month on a cross-border mission through Chad. The scale and magnitude of needs for children across the country are simply staggering. Sudan is now the world's largest displacement crisis, and some of the most vulnerable children are in the hardest to reach places.
That was Jill Lawler, Chief of Field Operations and Emergency for UNICEF in Sudan. The UN General Assembly is considering a draft for its first ever resolution on artificial intelligence. The measure was spearheaded by the U.S., which says it aims to make AI safe, secure and trustworthy and easily accessible to all. While presenting the draft resolution last week, a reporter asked U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, if the U.S. approves of Israel using AI in its assault on Gaza.
The Israeli military has confirmed they are using artificial intelligence in targeting in their war in Gaza. Do you condemn that? And will that be taken into your account in this AI resolution?
You know, we have been clear that this resolution is about making AI safe and secure and trustworthy. And we have 60 co-sponsors who have signed on to that, including Israel. And I think that as we move forward, we will see AI bridge many of the gaps that we've seen in the past.
You're fine with Israel using it in Gaza right now?
That's not for me to comment on.
This comes as the European Union approved last week its own first-ever Artificial Intelligence Act, but rights groups warn the legislation, they say, sets a dangerous precedent. The group Access Now said, quote, the new AI Act is littered with concessions to industry, lobbying exemptions for the most dangerous uses of AI by law enforcement and migration authorities, and prohibitions so full of loopholes that they don't actually ban some of the most dangerous uses of AI. Here in New York City, Mayor Eric Adams and the Legal Aid Society have reached a deal which preserves New York's right to shelter policy for unhoused people, but caps shelter stays by 30 or 60 days for newly arrived migrant adults. The settlement also bars New York City from forcing people to sleep on chairs and floors of so-called waiting rooms, where adult migrants wait in hopes of securing a shelter placement. Housing and immigrant justice groups welcome the protection of the right to shelter policy and said they will continue working towards making it applicable for all New Yorkers. The NYUCLU, New York Civil Liberties Union, said, quote, this rollback on the right to shelter could put thousands of people on the street. Everyone deserves a place to sleep, and that includes all new arrivals, they said. And a federal court temporarily paused new government rules that require public companies to disclose more information about their greenhouse gas emissions and the financial risks they face from the climate crisis. The case was brought by a pair of fracking companies. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to Rafah, as Israel's prime minister is vowing to move ahead with plans to attack Rafah, where nearly 1.5 million Palestinians have sought refuge. This Never-Ending Night by Kari Bremnes and Rimbana. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Gaza, where humanitarian agencies say a small amount of flour has been delivered in northern Gaza for the first time in months, as the UN Food Agency warns famine is imminent and 70% of Palestinians in Gaza are facing catastrophic hunger. This comes as UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, is reporting 1 in 3 children under the age of 2 in northern Gaza is now acutely malnourished as Israel continues to block block most aid from entering Gaza. On Friday, a ship carrying 200 tons of aid arrived in Gaza from Cyprus, but aid groups say far more aid is desperately needed inside Gaza. Despite growing international criticism, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is vowing to move ahead with a full-scale ground invasion of the southern city of Rafah, where over 1.4 million Palestinians are now seeking refuge. For more, we go to Rafah, where we're joined by Mohammed Abu Lebda. He's a poet and a translator. He used to translate Edgar Allan Poe, but now translates for the International Medical Corps. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mohammed. Thank you for joining us today on Democracy Now! Can you describe the situation on the ground in Rafah and tell us about your city?
Okay, hi. It's my pleasure to be here. Actually, as you may see in the background, I'm talking about the tents that are here. And I want to say that every single street in Rafah City is full of tents because after people were forced to be displaced from the rest areas of Gaza Strip from north until Khan Yunis in the south, and they didn't find any shelter but Rafah City, which actually, let me say that the border towns, Rafah is a border town, and the border towns usually are neglected, and it's not known, it's not even known only for geographers or even border guards. So Rafah was suffering in the normal days from bad infrastructure, lack of many basic life needs. So actually, let me say, in the war of 2014, the people of Rafah were demanding to have a hospital, because we here until now we are in 2024. We don't have a suitable hospital that can provide a good medical services to the people of Rafah. To just describe the horrible situation that is Rafah is living. Rafah used to have a population of 250,000 people only. Now we have over than 1.4 million people without any suitable infrastructure, or without providing them with the necessary basic life needs. Okay, the situation in the north of Gaza is really horrible, but let me say, in Rafah, there is no big difference. Actually, people here are suffering from several things. Actually, you need to wait in lines, and maybe you may spend the whole day in lines just to have some bread, or even to have a clean water, because most of the water here is polluted and it's not suitable for the human use. It's important to mention that above all of this, the shooting and the bombing is still continuing here in Rafah. Actually, even if even if Rafah was declared as a safe place.
Mohammed Abu Lebda, the Biden administration has said they have a red line that would be the prime minister having the Israeli troops engaging in a full ground invasion in Rafah if he doesn't present a plan for how Palestinians would be dealt with on the ground, civilians. Israel announced it wants to transfer most of the more than million Palestinians in Rafah to what it calls humanitarian islands in other parts of Gaza. Can you explain what that means and what people are saying, how they are preparing?
Okay, actually, to be honest, I don't know what does it mean even, because I never heard about something called safe islands or something like that in Gaza Strip. So it is the first time I heard it after reading the news. There is no effective plan that can easily transfer or move over than 1.4 million people here from Gaza Strip, so from Rafah City, I mean, even to another areas where the IDF is still working there. So to be clear, it's not an effective plan. Actually, to be honest, me and the rest of the Rafah people don't know even what they are talking about, because it is the first time to hear about this. But I can ask that the American government is to put a real pressure and a serious pressure on the Israeli government so they can prevent them seriously and honestly to invade Rafah, because invading Rafah means that there is a true catastrophe that is coming. Even if we are still living in a catastrophe, actually, because the situation here cannot be described. So invading Rafah means that you will end the teeny hope that is still we still have. So what does this mean to me? Actually, I'm a little bit worried about the safety of the entire people here, because invading Rafah, which means that hundreds of thousands will be killed if something like that happened. So I'm expecting and I'm hoping from the U.S. government to put a serious pressure on the Israeli government in order to prevent such a catastrophe to happen.
What would it mean for your family, Mohammed, if the Israeli military does launch a full-scale invasion of Rafah? And can you describe what the process is for people to leave, to make their way into Egypt, the thousands of dollars that must be spent? I think on average it's something like $5,000 per adult and $2,000 or $2,500 per child.
Let me say first, leaving Gaza Strip toward Egypt, I mean the entire people here, if there is an invade or march, or there is any marching to Rafah, most of the world, the U.S. government itself, actually they refuse that entirely. The Palestinians will not be moved. They refuse that entirely, to be moved to the Sinai or the Egyptian side. But let me say that I'm already displaced, because I lost my house by bombing some near houses near my house at the same square. So I forced to move to another place at the same area, Rafah City, because I'm from Rafah, and the same thing for the people who were displaced from the rest of Gaza Strip cities. For me, or for my experience, for me and my family, we suffered a lot first when we were at our house in order to provide the basic life needs, as I mentioned, the basic food. Even if there is any food here, you will find that very, very high prices that the normal citizen or the normal civilians cannot really afford. So it's impossible to the people in such a situation to afford any kind of food. And let me say that the any things that is entering from Rafah cross-boarding, anything literally, it's not even enough for maybe half a million. We are talking about a number that over than that with a big thing. So for my experience, I face several things. First of all, we face a very, very real threats, and it's not once, it's not even twice. We are even facing that daily. This is according to the physical thing. And also, I want to mention that we are facing a severe symptoms related to our mental health. Actually, I'm not sure that I'm going to be the person that I used to be before the war, when the war ends. I'm 100% sure that I'm not. I was changed, and I was changed for forever. It's not me only. I'm talking about my family and the rest of the people here of Gaza Strip. We are facing severe symptoms when we are talking about the mental health. We are talking about children that are raising in such situations. Of course, they are going to have severe symptoms and many horrible things for their mental health, and they will carry that to their entire life. From all sides, people here are really suffering. Yeah.
Mohammed, you are a poet. You translate Edgar Allan Poe. Now you are a medical translator. Can you describe your work?
Okay. Yeah, I used to work to translate novels as a literary translator. But this war, or this catastrophe, let me say, I don't prefer to use the word war, because what we are witnessing is a catastrophe cannot be described. Anyway, yeah, I used to translate literature, which means that I'm a sensitive person with many emotions, so you need that in order to translate poetry or translate novels or something like that. So as this catastrophe changed us forever, all of us, even our jobs. So yeah, I moved to be a medical translator and medical interpreter at a field hospital here near between Rafah City and Khan Yunis City in the south of Gaza Strip. Actually, my work as a medical translator, it was the first time to be in the field, actually, in such situations. And I can say that I'm witnessing a very horrible very, very, very horrible situations. I'm witnessing daily many casualties that are arriving to the field hospital because we don't have any. We lost every governmental medical services because of the destruction of many hospitals, even the only hospital here. Our people with the necessary medical services, as well as the mental health and the CP, which is the child protection, we are doing our ultimate efforts in order to provide the people, or the civilians and the innocent people here, to provide them with the medical services and other services. And let me use what Michel Foucault once said, because we are no prophets. Our job is to make windows where we were once walls. So we are trying hard is to create windows on the walls that this catastrophe is trying to build.
Finally, Mohammed Abu Lebda, we're going to be joined by Rachel Corrie's parents and the activist who held her hand as she lay dying. This is 21 years ago in Rafah. She was crushed to death by an Israeli military bulldozer as she tried to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian home. You shared with us a picture from Rafah in 2003. You were a little boy at the time, with the caption, "My grandmother with her neighbor and my sister Ozan after their home was destroyed by an Israeli bulldozer," right around the time Rachel was trying to protect homes as a U.S. activist. Your thoughts on her significance, and how is she remembered in Rafah?
Okay, let me say that Rachel Corrie is being remembered. Every single person here in Rafah, in Gaza in general, in Gaza Strip in general, and especially of Rafah, every single person knows Rachel Corrie. Even the late generations, all of them. Allow me to tell you the main reason. Actually, Rachel Corrie became an icon. not only here in Gaza Strip, not only for the Palestinians, the Palestinian people, but for the rest of the world, because she passed away, or she was killed because of her, because she was trying to deliver a very important message. It's the most important message in the world, which is peace. And actually, for me, this is the main thing that we need to focus on in order to achieve what Rachel Khoury was dreaming to achieve, which is a peace for the Palestinians. What matters of what matters for me in Rachel Khoury story is that she left her home. She left her parents and her family, and she came to a country that she never visited before, and she came into a conflict zone, which is considered as a dangerous zone. So her ideas to come to here, actually, it's a bravery. She's really I want to say that she's being remembered here because of the story and the message she tried to deliver, and this this and Rachel Khoury's story should strengthen us here while we are living these horrible situations. We need to remember Rachel Khoury and her courage to come to a dangerous area. Not only that, trying to defend the people, the voiceless people, to be the voice of the voiceless people here and to stand in front of the ultimate power. She stands in front of tanks and bulldozers trying to defend the people here in Gaza Strip, which I don't know what act will be greater than Rachel Khoury dead. So I'm really grateful for Rachel Khoury, and I want to say that people like Rachel Khoury will never die, ever.
Well, Mohammed Abu Lebda, poet and translator from Rafah, thank you so much. Your words are being heard around the world and by her parents, who are going to be joining us next. I'm looking at your GoFundMe page, Mohammed, which quotes another poet. You say, all what we seek for is to live like any human being in this earth. Helping us means you are taking action, supporting humanity. Because the famous poet Dante said, the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in times of great moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. Thank you for talking to us today on Democracy Now!, Mohammed Abu Lebda. Next up, we continue to remember the U.S. peace activist Rachel Khoury, killed 21 years ago, March 16, 2003, when she was crushed to death by an Israeli military bulldozer as she tried to prevent the demolition of the home of a Palestinian pharmacist. It was 3 days before the U.S. invaded Iraq. Back in 20 seconds. يا قلبي مثل دخان البوابير هو يلعن أبو الغربية يما وبلاد البرازيل ولا سعى فارق هالحباية Flood of Tears by Palestinian singer Jawaher Shofani. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Saturday marked the 21st anniversary of the death of U.S. peace activist Rachel Khoury. She was crushed to death by an Israeli military bulldozer in Rafah on March 16, 2003, 3 days before the U.S. attacked Iraq. Rachel was 23 years old. She was an Evergreen College student from Olympia, Washington. She went to Gaza with the International Solidarity Movement, which formed after Israel and the United States rejected a proposal by then-UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Mary Robinson to place international human rights monitors in the occupied Palestinian territories. Rachel Corrie was crushed to death by a U.S. Caterpillar bulldozer that was run by the Israeli military. She'd been trying to prevent the demolition of the home of a Palestinian pharmacist in Rafah, near the border with Egypt. Eyewitnesses say she was wearing a fluorescent orange vest. She was in full view of the bulldozer's driver, as photographs show. In June 2003, the Israeli military concluded her death was, quote, an accident. Human rights groups condemned the Israeli army's investigation as a sham. A year later, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff, told Rachel's parents he did not consider the Israeli investigation credible, thorough, or transparent. Rachel's parents initiated lawsuits against Israel, the Israeli military, and the Caterpillar Corporation. But a U.S. federal appeals court ruled they could not sue the company because that would force the judiciary to rule on a foreign policy issue decided by the White House. In its ruling, the three-judge panel said the case could not go to court without implicitly questioning and even condemning U.S. foreign policy towards Israel. In 2015, the Israeli Supreme Court rejected an appeal from Rachel Corrie's parents after they'd sued the Israeli military Ministry of Defense for a symbolic $1 in damages and upheld a lower court's ruling that cleared the military of responsibility, saying Rachel's death had taken place in a, quote, war zone. In a minute, we'll be joined by Rachel's parents and one of her colleagues with the International Solidarity Movement. But first, this is Rachel Corrie in her own words from a documentary about her by Concord Media called Death of an Idealist.
I've been here for about a month and a half now, and this is definitely the most difficult situation that I've ever seen. In the time that I've been here, children have been shot and killed. On the 30th of January, the Israeli military bulldozed the two largest water wells, destroying over half of Rafah's water supply. Every few days, if not every day, houses are demolished here.
More, we're joined in Olympia, Washington, by Rachel's parents, Cindy and Craig Corrie. After she was killed, they devoted their lives to what Rachel Corrie lived and died for, and founded the nonprofit Rachel Corrie Foundation for Peace and Justice. Cindy's the foundation's president, Craig the treasurer. They've also gone on interfaith peace missions to Israel, Gaza, the West Bank. Also with us in London is Tom Dale, a writer who's worked in civilian protection, conflict analysis, and journalism in the Middle East. His new piece for Jacobin is headlined, Rachel Corrie Gave Her Life for Palestine. In 2002 and 3, he too volunteered in Rafah with the International Solidarity Movement alongside Rachel. On March 16, 2003, a little after 5 p.m. in Rafah, he witnessed this U.S.-made bulldozer run over Rachel. He held her hand as she lay dying on a gurney in the ambulance taking her to the hospital. Welcome to all of you. I want to begin with Tom. Describe that day. What motivated you both, and what motivated Rachel to stand there in front of this bulldozer with that fluorescent vest on as it came forward and crushed her?
So to give some context and background, the International Solidarity Movement group in Rafah at that time were mostly concerned to protest against and oppose the demolition of homes that were being carried out on the border with Rafah and Egypt. And there was no allegation in the overwhelming majority of cases that these homes were being demolished due to anything that the people who lived in them had done. They were being demolished simply because Israel had decided that its soldiers based along that border strip wanted a tactical advantage, and that involved clearing a 300-metre strip full of family homes, the overwhelming majority of which were refugees. And now, at the particular time Rachel was killed, a bulldozer turned toward one of those homes, the home of Dr. Samir Nasrallah. Dr. Samir and his young family were friends of Rachel. She'd stayed with them. She'd lived with them. She knew them intimately. And she placed herself in between the bulldozer and the home, as we had done so many times before, and as we had done earlier in that day. And what we had learned over the course of several months is that the bulldozer drivers were able to see us, were able to recognise what would be too far, and they were able to stop or withdraw at an appropriate moment. But on this case, the bulldozer driver just kept on going. Rachel was sort of forced to climb up a kind of roiling mound of earth in front of the bulldozer. I think you heard earlier, Cindy quoted saying that her head was above the top of the bulldozer blade. That's absolutely accurate. It's almost as if the driver would have been able to look her in the eye. But as he kept going, ultimately she lost her footing and she was sucked down into the earth and terribly, horrifically died. At that point, I ran to call for an ambulance. I learned then that Dr. Samir himself had seen the incident too and had called the ambulance. And we had been living with these families, as I say. Rachel had been living with the Nasrallahs. I'd been living with other families along the border. And that was an expression of a really deep commitment to the principle of shared humanity. Rachel took on the cause of those families as if that cause was her own. And she made that cause her own. And that's what motivated us to take that stand.
You quote Rachel's diary. It's absolutely amazing. She wrote this, of course, before her death, and she said she had a dream. Do you have it in front of you, or I'll read it?
Please do read it. Thank you.
Rachel wrote, she dreamed that she was falling, quote, falling to my death off of something dusty and smooth and crumbling like the cliffs in Utah. But I kept holding on, and when each new foothold or handle of rock broke, I reached out as I fell and grabbed a new one. I didn't have time to think about anything, just react, and I heard, I can't die, I can't die, again and again in my head. If you can talk about what it means to hear Muhammad right now, talking about how Rachel is remembered, Tom, and what happened to you as you went in the ambulance with her to the hospital?
Yeah, that's correct. So, regrettably, by the time we got to the hospital, Rachel was dead. As I say, like on the way, I'd been sort of hot, just steadying her hands on her abdomen. Of course, it was like a terrible moment. We were all distraught. We knew Rachel. We cared for her greatly. She was one of us. Then immediately, of course, we were pushed into the cycle of responding to the series of bizarre lies that were being told by the Israeli Defense Forces. And in terms of what it means to hear, Mohammed say that right now, well, of course, I'm very grateful. It means a lot, given that, of course, the situation that Mohammed and his family and all of Rafarin is now is so terrible that he even has a thought for someone who was standing there 20 years ago is really remarkable and speaks to sort of the power of Rachel's message. And I really hope we can sort of repay that in the international community and use this just as an opportunity, as another spur to direct attention back to Rafah, direct our energies back toward putting the pressure on politically to protect Rafah from and Gaza in general from a future onslaught.
Tom, I want to bring in Rachel's parents, Cindy and Craig Corey, speaking from Olympia, Washington. That's where Rachel went to college. In fact, I think I met both of you for the first time back in 2003. I just happened to be giving the graduation address at Evergreen College that year. It was the largest graduation class ever, but it was missing one student who was supposed to be graduating, and it was your daughter, Rachel. And so, Cindy, you gave an address to the graduating class as well. 21 years later, I offer my condolences again to you. And I'm wondering your thoughts as you listen to Mohammed on the ground in Rafah, talking about your daughter and what she has meant for the people of Rafah, Gaza, and beyond.
Thank you, Amy. I had a bit of difficulty hearing Mohammed, but what I know from our experience this past 21 years is that for Palestinians everywhere, Rachel's story has been very important. They tell us over and over again how much it meant that someone from Olympia, Washington, that had no reason to be in Gaza, except that she had learned about the situation and knew that they were greatly in need. Demolition of the many demolitions of Palestinian homes that were happening at the time. And Rachel connected with the community. That was important to her. She worked with women's groups, with children's groups. Not only were homes threatened, but wells were threatened. She slept at the wells with other activists. Rachel was there with Tom and with others from the UK, from the US, and people from other countries during the early time that she spent in Gaza. We're also often approached by younger people who have heard the story. Some, when they were children, that remember it and tell us that it changed their lives, changed the course of the direction of their lives, that they then felt that there were meaningful things that they needed to look for, meaningful ways to contribute in this world.
And Craig, your thoughts as well, 21 years later, with Rafah once again in the news, with President Biden saying that an Israeli invasion of Rafah is a red line, but not saying there would be consequences if the Israeli military went over that line.
Yes, when I was listening today, I was thinking that for me, and it's different for other members of the family, but we were using Rachel's memory and what she was doing to as a portal for people to understand, from the United States, to understand what was going on in Gaza, what was happening to her friends, and partially the horror that's going on now. And I think at this point, we have to be looking directly at the Palestinians and hearing their voices, as you allowed today. There's never been a red line that any American president has, well, that's not quite true, but recently enforced against Israel. And to me, as long as Israel is coveting the lands and the homes of Palestinian people, there will not be peace in Israel and Palestine, and neither the Israeli people nor the Palestinian people will be safe. So I think really the difference between Rachel, Tom, the rest of the ISM, the difference between them and the rest of us is that they refused to look away when all this was going on, and the rest of the world did look away.
You know, one of the ways Rachel's words have been preserved was because of Alan Rickman. And Craig, I just read a piece you wrote after the actor and director Alan Rickman died. You wrote it in The Guardian. And you talked about what a difference he made in making those words into that play, My Name is Rachel Corey, based on her diaries and her emails. And I'm looking at a piece. 6 weeks before opening night, the theater announced it was indefinitely postponing the production. The move that was widely criticized as an act of censorship finally opened in October
2006. And if either of you could comment on the canceling of people in this country and around the world now who express concern about what's happening in Gaza, and also talk about your trip to meet with the Nasrallahs, the Palestinian pharmacist family whose home Rachel was protecting.
That's a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
I'll start with Alan and the play. And I guess in that article, what I thought of is that that play, what people won't understand about it is that it's actually funny. He managed to get Rachel's sense of humor. And he edited those words along with Catherine Viner, and we're grateful to both of them. But he managed to get Rachel's humor into the play, and I think that brought her personality. It made her human, and I'm grateful forever for that. The play has been seen on every continent in the United States, in the world, and except Antarctica. And we've, Cindy and I have seen that, I think, in maybe 6 countries and 7 different languages. So it was delayed in opening in the United States, but it had 2 runs in Great Britain, in London, before that. And it did eventually open in New York City. And since then, it's been also all over the United States. And it's actually, there's going to be a reading in a few days in Seattle again. Hmm. So I'll let Cindy talk, I think, more about the other.
We visited the Nasrallah family in September of 2003. It was our first trip to the region. It was very important for Craig and me to see the place where Rachel had stayed and where her life ended. We traveled to Rafah with the help of our Palestinian friends who met us at Erez Crossing. And we were taken the very first day that we were there. We were taken to the area where the Nasrallah home still stood. And it was the only home left in that entire area. What I remember saying and feeling at the time was that house was sitting in a sea of rubble because the Israeli military was destroying homes wholesale. Later, Human Rights Watch said that happened in the absence of military necessity. And over 16,000 people, I think from 2000 to 2004, lost their homes at the time. That day, we sat on the floor in the Nasrallah family's home and ate a wonderful lunch meal with Om Karim, with Abu Karim, and with their very young children at the time. We were taken to the spot by Abu Karim, showing us exactly where Rachel had been when she was killed. It was a very emotional day. We hugged. We saw the rooms in the house where Rachel had spent time with the children and the family. They pulled off their Arabic English dictionary from the shelf and had me read, try to pronounce the words in Arabic. And they told me how Rachel was so much better at it than I was. And we saw also the space at the foot of the Nasrallah parents' bed, which was at the backside of the house, where Rachel would sleep, she said, in a puddle of blankets with the children, because military people and machines would drive through that border area at night and they would shoot into the houses. And there were bullet holes marking the entire home.
We just have 30 seconds, and I just wanted to get your final comment, either Cindy or Craig, on what is happening today.
Amy, that family did everything they could to hold on to that house. They were eventually forced out of that house, and some of them went through 7 other houses. Now we hear that they want out of Gaza. After 21 years of trying to hold on to their homes and their lives and their futures and their past in Gaza, like so many people, they want to survive and they want out. I can't imagine what drives them to do that, but That's the situation in Gaza.
I want to thank you both for being with us again, Craig and Cindy Corey, speaking to us from Olympia, Washington. And Tom Dale, will link to your piece in Jacobin, Rachel Corey Gave Her Life for Palestine, joining us from London. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Check out our website at democracynow.org.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a deep dive into two recent Supreme Court oral arguments that have profound implications for the First Amendment in the Internet age.
Our guest, attorney Zach Wolf, will make a prediction on what he thinks the right-wing Supreme Court will do.
We'll also speak with award-winning author Robin Anderson about U.S.-Israel media genocide complicity.
There's no one in the country more knowledgeable than Robin Anderson. She's from Fair and Activist in the Media and Project Censored, and she'll give us her idea of what's going on with the media.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Last month, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments about two state laws that would regulate how large tech companies control what content can appear on their sites. Republican legislators in Florida and Texas aim to address what they claim are efforts to stifle conservative voices on platforms like Facebook and YouTube. In part, these laws came about after platforms banned Donald Trump for violating their rules against inciting violence in his posts related to the January 6, 2021 Capitol insurrection. The laws would compel companies to carry all users' viewpoints. It would also preclude them from deplatforming political candidates. The Florida law at issue in Moody v. NetChoice and its Texas counterpoint, NetChoice v. Paxton, represent challenges by technology lobbying groups, NetChoice and the Computer and Communications Information Association. The plaintiffs claim the laws violate their First Amendment rights to make editorial choices about what content to permit or to prohibit. They say it will be virtually impossible to monitor and prevent hate speech, pro-terrorism advocacy, and content that could harm children. Joining us today to share his reactions to the oral arguments is professor, author, and attorney Zachary Wolf. Zach, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Zach, we're going to begin with the opening statement of Henry Whitaker, the Solicitor General of Florida in Moody v. NetChoice. It's just under 5 minutes. Let's take a listen.
Moody versus NetChoice. Mr. Whitaker?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Internet platforms today control the way millions of Americans communicate with each other and with the world. The platforms achieved that success by marketing themselves as neutral forums for free speech. Now that they host the communications of billions of users, they sing a very different tune. They now say that they are in fact editors of their user speech, rather like a newspaper. They contend that they possess a broad First Amendment right to censor anything they host on their sites, even when doing so contradicts their own representations to consumers. But the design of the First Amendment is to prevent the suppression of speech, not to enable it. That is why the telephone company and the delivery service have no First Amendment right to use their services as a choke point to silence those they disfavor. Broadly facilitating communication in that way is conduct, not speech. And if Verizon asserted a First Amendment right to cancel disfavored subscribers at a whim, that claim would fail, no less than the claimed right to censorship failed in Prunard versus Robbins and Rumsfeld versus Fair. Social networking companies, too, are in the business of transmitting their users' speech. Their users are the ones who create and select the content that appears on their sites. The platforms indeed disavow responsibility for that conduct in their terms of service. The platforms do sort and facilitate the presentation of user speech. But this court, just last term in Twitter versus Tamina, and the platforms themselves in Gonzalez versus Google, described those tools as little more than passive mechanisms for organizing vast amounts of third-party content. The platforms do not have a First Amendment right to apply their censorship policies in an inconsistent manner and to censor and deplatform certain users. I welcome your questions.
Counsel.